It is Sunday, August 18th, 2013, and this is episode 31 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. With me tonight is co-host Andrew Callett. And as usual, the thoughts and opinions both Mr. Callett and I express on this show are ours and don't represent those of our employers. So, getting into stories. The first thing we have to talk about tonight is the looming retirement of Windows XP. So
wait. Before you get into that, Jerry.
Uh-oh.
I want to say hello to all of our podcast listeners.
Seriously.
And, you know, for those out there who are curious, Jerry and I chit-chat a bit before the show, and I learned something stunning, which is Jerry does not know who Joe Rogan is, so feel free to send him some hate mail on that. And, you know, only running one of the most successful, widely listened to podcasts in the world, just saying, you know. So anyway, go on. Let's get to stories.
Well, there you have it. Anyway, back on track. Windows XP going to die April 8th, 2014. InfoWorld has an article about fire and brimstone, cats and dogs living together after this date. So basically, the net of the article is that all the bad guys, right, are finding XP vulnerabilities and they're sitting on them because there's not a lot of money to be made until after next April. So after next April, when Microsoft doesn't publish any more updates, the thinking is that these guys and girls, presumably, can at least double their money because XP vulnerabilities become a lot more valuable. That's the thinking anyway. What do you think, Andy?
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. You know, Microsoft's going to stop patching, right? So anybody who cares about security ideally is going to upgrade past this, right? So, you know, from a defensive standpoint, please upgrade past XP. There's a lot more technology built into Windows 7. We'll forget Windows 8 exists for a moment. For securing your boxes and, you know, in general, don't run Windows XP is a pretty common thing. But back to the point, yeah, I can see that. It's really just a matter of economics, right? How many XP boxes are going to be out in the world? And I don't think it's just the bad guys. You know, we all know at this point that it's also a number of governments are buying zero days and other issues like that so that they can do weaponized attacks. So certainly, I think that this is, you know, it's a lot of conjecture. It's a lot of people kind of guessing. I think it'd be interesting to see if they're right or not. They're also kind of predicting that there's going to be a fall off in published Windows XP exploits as everybody's kind of banking them and waiting. We'll see. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think anybody who's serious about security is going to get off XP. And those who are still on XP, hopefully they'll get the warning. Because it's going to get pretty lonely out there, and you know, until XP is such a small portion of the market that the bad guys don't care anymore, right? So if you went back and ran OS2 Warp, you're probably pretty secure because nobody's attacking that.
Right. And one of the statistics quoted in the article, which was a little surprising to me, and you know, I don't know if it's real or not, but I think they said about a third, or at least they're projecting about a third of systems in enterprises will still be running XP at the time that XP is sunset. And that's pretty surprising, but I guess not entirely unexpected given how difficult some of these migrations can be.
Yeah. End of the day, it comes down to a cost, right? You know, like anything else, it's operational cost, and the upgrade cycle is important. And this is one thing that I've seen over and over again is that things don't get upgraded. If it isn't broke, don't fix it. Don't touch it. But that ultimately will lead to problems. You know, yeah. I see this all the time with ancient firmware running on routers and switches, and you know, you never know what's out there. These are living, breathing organisms now that we have to stay on top of, and it has to be built into your IT world that you have to upgrade. The problem is, you know, kind of going off on a mini rant here, I see this all the time when people are doing pen tests and they say, or scans or anything like this, don't touch the system. It's sensitive. It's fragile. Well, if it's fragile for the good guys, how fragile is it going to be for the bad guys?
Exactly.
You know, so end of the day, this comes back around to, you know, blocking and tackling of just basic IT management and accepting the cost of upgrades as part of that, as much as it may suck.
Definitely. Now, there's a couple other things that bothered me about this, and it's a subtle thing. On the second page of this article, you know, they try to enumerate the problem by quoting some statistics Microsoft had published. I think they said 11.3 machines per thousand scanned were found to be infected. And, you know, the interesting thing is they're conflating infections with vulnerabilities. So, you know, sometimes you have to take some of these statistics with a grain of salt. But I think the net point is that, you know, it is going to be a significant issue. Now, whether Microsoft releases another set of patches sometime in May, you know, I think the problem is going to exist no matter what, right? Because if what they're saying is true, and there's going to be tens or hundreds of millions of systems still running on XP, you're going to have bad guys, whether those are governments or, you know, organized crime, attacking them. And there's just no getting around that.
Yeah, I'd be very curious too where those stats come from. I wonder if it's a malicious removal tool or, you know, what it may be saying. But, you know, the other thing to be said here too is that we've seen a big shift between attacking the base OS and going after, you know, the applications or the plugins on that OS anyway.
Right.
So,
exactly.
You know, whether you're on XP or Windows 7, Java is still a big flaming pile of poo that's easily exploitable. So, you know, that's the problem. End of the day, this is just one more thing you have to worry about. I don't know. I kind of, with all due respect to this article and the folks who wrote it and the folks commented on it, this was kind of a very speculative article that had a lot of, this is what I think is going to happen. And, you know, I don't know. I didn't put a lot of stock in this particular article as a great predictor. But it's interesting to think about.
Well, I think it starts to really hopefully build that burning platform that people need to take action. If they haven't done it already, they need to start tightening the screws in the organization to get migrated off, because they just have to do it, right? You know, I know XP is working for a lot of people, and it works very well for a lot of people, but unless you're going to throw Microsoft a whole bunch of money for some extended support, you got to move.
Yeah, and that's really what it comes down to. Now, I get it. Not every organization, especially small organizations, you know, care about this stuff or have the money for this stuff. But we're here to talk about solutions. And, you know, you can make a lot of reasons why things won't work. But at the end of the day, we're here to talk about what does work. And at least for this particular article, you know, upgrade.
Exactly. Enough said. All right, let's move on to the next one. This is about the Department of Energy here in the U.S. For the second time in about 8 months, they have been hacked. And it is very unclear what the details are. I thought this was particularly important because, you know, the Department of Energy is out on the forefront of trying to protect our critical infrastructure, and in particular, our power grid and things like that. And here we are. They can't keep their employee data safe.
Yeah, and, you know, this article makes it sort of, it has this implication that, well, if the DOE can't do it, right? But in my experience, with all due respect to all of these government organizations, they are terrible at information security. Aside from the military, right? They do a good job of keeping their classified stuff classified, you know, aside from active leaking and that sort of thing. You know, but they could take a, you know, a pretty hard line, but you know, the crazy part with these government organizations is they just don't have good quality folks, and they don't have good quality InfoSec guys on staff. Typically, those guys are out in the industry on the private side. So yeah, it's sad. Who knows? There's very little information, so we don't know how this information right. was accessed. We don't know if it came from a payroll organization. We don't know where it was in their organization.
Yeah, or even if it's tied to the initial breach.
Right.
Yep.
Or, you know, not to be too cynical, but I wonder how many of these things happen that we don't even hear about.
Because good point.
It's the government. But at the end of the day, for me, what this comes back down to, you know, at an individual level is I've almost gotten to a point where I just assume that my personal information is going to get leaked by somebody who has it. And, you know, one thing I've argued over and over again on this personal identification stuff is if we could just have a process where we could change our social security number at a you know, universal level, much like we handle a credit card that gets breached or leaked, we could solve a lot of problems. But because we can't change our credit, you know, our social security number in any easy way, once it's out there, it's out there. It's like biometrics. That's one reason I'm not a huge biometric fan. I can't change my thumbprint once it's
exactly.
out
there. Exactly. And you leave it at every bar you go to.
Right. Wait, what are you saying? Are you saying I go to a lot of bars? Who have you been talking to?
No, I meant me. I leave it at every bar you go. Never mind.
Oh. Huh? Anyway. So, I don't know. I don't have a ton that we can say because the article is kind of lacking in a lot of information here. But in general, my experience has been that most of the government agencies, InfoSec's pretty low on their list. They typically have like a person appointed as the InfoSec person in that office who might have been the secretary last week, yeah. You know. So it'd be interesting. It'd be really interesting to know a lot more of what happened with this DOE leak.
My assessment from what I've seen and what I've read about other breaches is that outside of the intelligence community and the military, most of the government agencies are stuck fending for themselves.
Yeah.
So they have to staff IT and IT security with their own resources. They don't get to go to the high-priced external consultants who then leak your data from their villa in Hawaii. But I think you're right. You know, they're competing at a pretty big disadvantage. The government doesn't pay all that well. You know, probably as soon as somebody starts making, you know, gets to a level of competence, you know, there's almost negative unemployment in the security world. You can go and get a job somewhere else, make more money. So,
really, I need to have a chat with my boss.
Yep, there you go. Okay, the next article is actually the most interesting one to me. And so this is something that came out of B-Sides Las Vegas. It was a presentation by Ed Bellis and Mike Reutemann, if I'm saying that right. And it's a very long article. There's a YouTube video of the presentation, which is about 45 minutes long. It's worth watching, in my opinion. And I'll sum it out, right? It's that our reliance on CVSS scores as an indicator of the importance of vulnerability is not very useful. You know, and the reason it's not useful is because it's not a real predictor of which things are going to get you attacked. And so their point is it makes more sense to look at the combination of what's in the exploit DB and Metasploit versus what has a high CVS score. So, you know, if you're trying to prioritize the 10 patches you want to apply out of 100, you really should focus on those that are, you know, in Metasploit and exploit DB, because those are the ones that the attackers are going to use to get you.
Yeah, this is pretty cool stuff, and it brings up a lot of thoughts. I think they're onto something here. You know, at the same time, I would say that even the best case scenario, they had what, a 30% success rate?
Yes.
In there, you know, basically saying that If you do just go after things that are in Metasploit and XploitDB, that gives you the best success rate, but that success rate is still
30%.
Only 30%. So it comes back to, you know, a saying I like to have, which is that security is like real estate. It's all local. It all depends on what matters to you and your organization. Understanding your risks and your threat vectors, but also this concept of, all right, this is basically, you got to do it. You got to patch, you got to address vulnerabilities.
Absolutely.
And if you've got limited budget, these are the best ones to go after. 100% agree with that. But from a mindset standpoint, still, I believe in assuming you are going to get breached. And then how do you mitigate, control, find, identify, and limit that breach as quickly as you can? So a little off topic, but it goes back to reinforcing that, hey, you know, you're going to get nailed. But I think this is cool stuff. And I think it's, one thing that I, I'll start this way. How do you know when you meet a pilot, Jerry?
They tell you?
Yes, pretty much. So for the listening audience, I am a pilot, a private pilot, and I've been in aviation for about 15 years. And it's true that we're not shy about telling you. But the reason I bring this up is that I've been looking a lot at how the aviation industry handles risk and identifying risk and mitigating those risks. And I'm trying to figure out what we can do with bringing some parallels between that world of aviation over into information security. Mind you, it's a completely different world. It's heavily regulated. It's, things cost millions of dollars because of all the regulations. I'm not saying that. That's a whole different thing. But they have a very rigorous methodology of identifying risk, deconstructing anything that happens so that other people can learn from it. And so what I like about this approach that these guys are doing is it reminds me of a very sort of scientific analysis of what really is working and not working, as opposed to, hey, here's all this massive amounts of information security guy, good luck, figure it out. It's like we don't have a best practice so much right now as we do just keep throwing technology at it, keep throwing, best practices at it, and, hopefully that works.
Right. Yeah, the thing there's a lot of things I thought interesting about it. First I want to mention is, if you rely solely on CVSS scores, and again, this is from the perspective of what's going to get you attacked, not necessarily from the perspective of, what's the biggest academic or hypothetical risk situation, but, kind of doing regression testing of what things led to a successful attack happening, relying on CVSS scores is only markedly better than randomly picking which patches you're going to apply out of all patches. And I thought that was really very interesting. And so for me, the point is, we probably ought to take a step back and think about how we're prioritizing patches, right? Because we all do it. All businesses have some function that, and no matter how simple it is. I mean, if it's it could be the office manager who, once a month decides that he's going to go and, push out some patches through WSUS or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. We all do it to different levels of complexity. The point is, what this is showing is CVSS isn't what we thought it was.
Right.
At least from the perspective of this study. Now, maybe other studies would show something different.
Would you say that it's led to a false sense of security or knowledge by relying on CVSS based on what these guys are saying?
I would say yes.
Yeah. It's interesting too that they kind of go in with the assumption that you can't do all patches. And I think that is probably true for some situations. And, patching in and of itself is a risk. Right. You could potentially incur downtime. You could potentially incur breaking something, incompatibility. Right. And but if you're doing that risk analysis, how do you compare the risk of patching with the risk of not patching? Is one thing that occurs to me as well. I know, I just put you on the spot there.
Well, I guess it depends. Right. So I think you have to look at the right, or look through the right lens. So if you're looking through the lens that they're proposing here, right? So if you're If you're saying, I'm not going to apply a patch to something that was just added to Metasploit, that's probably a bad idea, because what they're saying is that you now have a 30% chance that that thing you've chosen not to patch is going to be exploited.
Right. And I wonder, too, if there's anything about this that is somewhere around the, what I want to say, something along the lines of, are the bad guys somehow looking at this data as well to figure out what to use to attack?
I don't know. Imagine so.
Right. And, you know, of course, this is always an arms race, and it's always a, you know, so is this stat, is this sort of tendency incidental to bad CVS scoring, or is it incidental to the behavior of a statistically large amount of bad guys on this stuff?
So interestingly, and here is the nuance that I picked up from watching the video, and it's not overtly said. I'm going to infer something here.
I was supposed to watch the video?
You should watch it. It's actually pretty good.
No, I do want to.
Okay. But I know I didn't give you enough time, right? So it's my fault, whatever. So anyway, what you miss if you don't watch the video is, and again, they don't say it even in the video, is the point is that the attackers are relying on Metasploit and ExploitDB. They're not, as a rule, all that sophisticated. And so the reason you rely on Metasploit and ExploitDB as indicators of the likelihood that something's going to be compromised is because the bad guys are using those tools.
Fair enough. You know, the other thing I'll say that I liked about this is that this was a cool talk that came out of B-Sides Las Vegas, which runs parallel to DEF CON.
Yes.
And, you know, I like the B-Sides group a lot. And just in general, if you guys haven't attended a B-Sides, I'd recommend it. It's good stuff, and they should be supported.
Absolutely. There was one other and, you know, I have to take a step back for a second and say, you know, this story was sent to me by one of the listeners, and he actually mentioned it in the context of a fairly subtle nuance. And one of the points is that IDS and second generation firewalls in 26% of cases can't detect what Metasploit's putting out. And so their point is, well, what's with that? You know, you've got Metasploit. What's the reason? Why do you not detect that? And so, you know, I suppose everybody's got a story for what's going on there, but, you know,
I have the theory that it's the we suck less theory. We're not perfect as a vendor. We just suck less than the next guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So the context that this person sent the article to me was, you know, how do we view IDS, IPS? You know, is it similar to antivirus? You know, most of the security people are completely dogging on antivirus, saying, you know what, it's totally useless. It doesn't serve a purpose. It can't catch everything. It doesn't even catch most things. So why even do it? And I put together a pretty long response, which I thought was really good. But, you know, in my mind, I think both IDS and AV have a big purpose. In AV, you know, my intention for it, my purpose for it might be a little different. It's not, you know, when I think about AV, I'm not thinking about, you know, what was its detection rate of unknown threats last month. That's not the most important metric to me. What the most important metric is to me is if I give them a sample, how fast can they turn around a def update?
Is that really valid anymore in today's world of brand new unseen malware where they can morph in moments?
In my experience, it is, right? I see a number of cases where you've got you'll get an organization that is hit, and there may be 30 or 40 different variants, but there aren't an infinite number of variants. There's a fairly fixed number of variants, and there's different reasons specific to each particular piece of malware that you're talking about. But in my mind, what I like to be able to do is work with these antivirus companies and have them help me clamp down on further distribution. So I like to have them, you know, while the end dropped thing might morph, what we see less of is the droppers being polymorphic, right? So a lot of times the droppers are common. And so if you can get your AV company to detect that, it, you know, obviously you still have a problem. If you got lots of systems infected in your network, you know, you have to go clean that up. You don't want to just let AV go do the work, right? Because, you know, as I've talked about in the past, it's a bad idea, but you can use AV to help stop propagation, new propagation.
Yeah. If your AV vendor, one, reacts quick enough, two, yes, you've got good samples, three, it is non-polymorphic, you know,
right.
I'm a little more cynical about the AV world. I hear what you're saying. I don't disagree. I just, you know, there's a reason that there's a whole new industry building out there to supplement AV. And it's because Absolutely. There's a whole bunch of stuff out there that AV just isn't seeing. You know, you're hoping somebody else gets infected first.
Yeah.
Right. And
you know, the other thing I use AV for is an indicator, right? So an indicator of the likelihood that something is amiss, right? And so you may not be able to detect that thing, but in a lot of cases, if you see, like, for instance, if you know, if you are managing an antivirus console and you see my PC, you know, flagging up all kinds of crap, and a lot of it's being blocked, you know, why, right? Is there something on my computer that's trying to pull down something that is being detected? Am I doing something that's risky? Am I going to bad websites? Am I, you know, something's going on that yeah. warrants some investigation. And I see IDS is very similar, right? So in many cases, IDS, IPS can't stop that primary attack, but it can detect, you know, the after effect, right? So
right.
Once somebody's compromised your system, they often do very common and deterministic things. They're going to launch attacks. They're going to try to, you know, use that as a pivot point to run port scans inside your network and those kinds of things that your IDS engine can detect because they're very commodity.
I think that's true for some malware. I think some malware is very quiet these days and is looking for very specific information.
Absolutely.
I agree.
100% solution.
No, my God, there isn't. And that is one thing that I had a long conversation with, and I have to be very careful about ever talking about anything from my current employer, but I had a long conversation with a customer. They're looking for an advanced malware solution, and we had a lot of conversation about what really is possible and what isn't. And there is no 100% solution at all. There's probably not even a 90% solution. There's probably not an 80% solution, but you got to do something, right? And so going back to your point, though, that I agree with and I like a lot is the concept of instrumenting your environment enough to be able to detect when you do have a breach.
Yes.
And whether that is AV or, you know, the new buzzword of security analytics or whatever it may be, I think that's incredibly important because, you know, then at least when it does get by whatever you've got running out there, you know it hopefully relatively quickly.
Right.
And
I think that's becoming more the order of the day. I think people are becoming resigned to the fact that the attacks, whether they're government sponsored or organized crime or, you know, even just more amateur, the tools are becoming much more refined. Mm-hmm. You don't have the ability to stop it all. You just can't. And so the most you really have the hope of doing is minimizing the time they have in your environment.
So this is the happy fun hour of InfoSec.
Yeah.
Good luck. Well. So, back to the story. I think these guys are onto something, and I think that the more work we can do in terms of, you know, really kind of doing some hardcore stats on what is effective, the more we can help everybody in the industry.
Absolutely. Completely agree. So, you know, in that respect, I follow this mailing list. It's the Society for Information Risk Analysts. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting list. And I've previously talked about being interested in the quantitative aspects of security and risk management. And that's what this group is. And there have been a lot of, I'll say, very angry conversations back and forth. But, you know, when you read those kinds of things, you learn a lot. I mean, I've learned a ton by watching people that are far smarter than me argue, because they have to defend themselves. So if you look, you know, if you're so motivated, go Google Society for Information Risk Analysts and, you know, get on their mailing list and follow them. Some really good discussions. I think it will definitely, in my view, help. Particularly if you're in the position of having to justify your budgets and things like that, that's where this starts to help. You know, how do you portray to your management that, you know, you need to make an investment, because you can, it helps you put it into dollars.
Right.
So anyway, I thought that's worthwhile mentioning. So the
you could also, you know, tweet out a link, just saying.
You know, that's brilliant. That Twitter.
I'm here to add value.
You do. More than you know.
Carry on.
All right. The last story is about LavaBit. And I know this one's been done to death, especially on a number of the other security podcasts. But there's a couple of nuances that I wanted to talk about. And, you know, number one, obviously, this guy, the Ladar, I don't remember his last name. Ladar, you know, obviously, in my view, got a national security letter, and he can't talk about it and all that. It's concerning to me. And here's where it starts to unwind for me. This is a high-tech entrepreneur. He has a small company, provides secure email services based in the U.S. And in his own words, he's over the years, over the past 10 years, he says he's complied with dozens of court order requests for specific sets of data. But apparently he got a national security letter that ordered him to do something much more broad. Now, you know, we would have to speculate what that is, probably something like installing a TAP or something onerous like that. But to me, the net point is, you know, this is kind of like a wet blanket to IT entrepreneurship in the U.S.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty much, you want to get into IT, especially anything related to any sort of communication, prepare to bend over and take it from the government.
And that's really sad for me. So not without respect or regard for your politics or whatever you think about Edward Snowden or the NSA or anything like that, here we have a situation where, number one, people, especially because in the IT industry, there tends to be a pretty strong overlap between high-tech people and people who are interested in privacy. It just is, right? That's my observation. You know, these people aren't going to be doing that. And so I think the U.S. is at extreme risk of losing some of our competitive edge, and especially when you start reading some of the other articles about, you know, a lot of other countries like Germany and Australia and others are saying, hey, you know what? If you value your privacy, don't do business with U.S. online companies.
Yeah, it's, you know, one thing that occurred to me is Phil Zimmerman was right. He told us this was going to happen about 10 years ago, when, you know, more than that, whenever PGP was first in its infancy. And, you know, what it tells me is you cannot, if you want true privacy for whatever reason, you know, you could be doing something completely legitimate and still want privacy with your business communications. You know, we've heard countless stories of, for instance, industrial espionage going on from all sorts of nation states trying to give their own businesses competitive advantage. So it's perfectly within the realm of normal, legitimate legal behavior to want to encrypt your business communication. And what this is telling me is that you can no longer trust any sort of third-party off-local box encryption. If you can't encrypt it locally on your own machine and hope that that machine is also, by the way, uncompromised, and control your private key, you probably have to assume that there's a backdoor in that communication somewhere. And that is really sad. And I agree with you that this is probably, you know, we're hearing all these comments about how this is going to kill a certain segment of the cloud computing computer environment, and certain businesses are going to take, you know, billions of dollars of lost revenue as a result. But, you know, this also reminds me a bit of, you know, a key scene in the book and the movies Atlas Shrugged, which is where, you know, one of the guys who is a big oil field producer says, "I've had enough," and he burns down his oil fields. And I don't want to see that. I don't want to see these guys who are providing services that people find valuable giving up and leaving and just saying to hell with it. And again, regardless of the politics, and I'm much more willing to get into the political side of it than I think Jerry is, but I just really think it's a shame that you know, I applaud this guy for taking a stand. He's probably going to go through hell, you know, right or wrong or indifferent. It's, you know, he's trying to use the law to fight, but it's very, very, very difficult when you have a gag order and you can't even talk about it. I'm curious if he can even talk about it with his lawyer. I would assume he can, but I don't know.
No, I have heard that he can't. I've heard that he's not allowed to disclose the terms of whatever notice he got with his lawyer.
That's...
And now, the other thing, you just jogged my memory, the other thing that was interesting about this is the mere fact that he has publicly said he's stepping away because something transpired with the government. He's basically being told that the government is trying to figure out what he did wrong there.
Wow. So if you want to get really paranoid for a moment, you could see the government coming at this from an angle of if everybody who's in the, you know, data transmission industry, whether that be ISPs, you know, whether that be email providers, whomever it may be, whoever has the data the government wants, if they're not going to play ball with us, we're going to find a way to drum them out of business.
Yeah.
And that's just wrong. Right. And, you know, I'm hoping 10 years from now, we're going to look back and realize how crazy this all was, but I don't think so. I think that 10 years from now, we're going to be in a worse spot than we are today, because so few are pushing back on this. And, you know, I wish this guy luck. I hope that he can figure out a way to, you know, defend his name, but he's going to probably spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on this. Definitely. And, you know, I'm sure that the government doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. They're trying to fight terrorism, right? And find leaks and all that jazz.
Absolutely.
But,
it's all a matter of perspective.
But you can't have a risk-free society and also have freedom. So it's I don't know. It's a depressing thing for me. It's a depressing story for me, because this is what we want to foster. We want to foster this kind of entrepreneurship. And this guy was, you know, doing some good stuff. And for the government, basically, if we're reading between the lines, come in here and say that we need a backdoor to all your stuff. And we don't know that to be true, but that's kind of the assumption here that I'm working under. You know, that's wrong on a lot of levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other alternative is that he's an attention whore, and you know, yeah, none of it's true. So
you know, that is a possibility. I hadn't considered that. You bring up a fine point. We don't know the other side of it, right? So there could be somebody out there listening to this podcast who does know the other side of it, screaming at their playback device of how ignorant we are to the reality of the situation. And to be fair, we don't know.
We don't know. Absolutely.
You know, and you're right. This could be somebody being an attention whore, but you know.
But I think the reason I bring it up is not necessarily from the political perspective of, you know, how I feel about spying or anything like that. This is the business perspective. And I right. see the optics of what's going on is negatively impacting the tech industry here. And that's very bothersome to me for a lot of different reasons. And I really hope we find some way to turn it around.
Yeah, I agree. And I think probably what's going on and what has been going on is the government's been leaning on these big IT corporations to play ball, whatever that means, right? And, you know, I think probably most of them have, rightly or wrongly. And, you know, small guys, once they get on the radar, it's going to be tough.
Right.
And that, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to start a business, you know, unless I was already independently wealthy and had a lot of great lawyers on staff and were doing it just to make a point. I probably wouldn't get anywhere near anything that had to do with, you know, starting a business through secure email right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely not.
And that's a shame. And that's purely out of, you know, the concern of the hassle of the government coming down on me.
Right.
You know, and you know, I also kind of, I don't know if this is true or not, but I also kind of read between the lines a little bit that this guy was saying, I can't provide the service I thought I was providing. I can't in good conscience say that the email system is secure. But I don't know. I'd love to know. Maybe someday we will. I don't know, you know, if these gag orders will ever expire.
Yeah, hopefully we will. The other thing that concerns me is, you know, again, we don't know specifically what's being asked, but, you know, hypothetically, if there is some instrumentation that's being added, you know, what does that do? We know, for instance, in the case of Aurora, right? We know what happened there. And there's even more coming out all the time, right? That, you know, it was some of the Kalia type backdoor that was being leveraged by attackers.
Right.
And so, you know, it's the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah, it is a source of frustration, and it is a source of concern from a business perspective, for sure. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, most businesses are going to say it's a cost of doing business.
Yeah, and I agree.
It will become normal, and that's kind of sad, but I think at the end of the day, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right. When we look at back at this, I think we probably will wonder what the hoopla was about, but probably not because it's changed, but because it's become more acceptable.
Yeah.
So with that happiness, you know, hey, they got a job to do. They're doing it the way they feel necessary. If, you know, if we feel that's not the right way, we have a democratic process to go and address it. So, you know, there you have it.
Yeah. Well, we also are supposed to have a constitution that's supposed to limit certain powers as well, but hey,
Absolutely.
You know, on the upside, I'm hoping people are liking this format of you and I, you know, doing a lot more discussion, you know, rather than just presenting stories, that you and I are doing a lot more analysis. Hopefully people find that interesting and not boring. You know, we might be putting people to sleep. I hope not.
Some of the feedback I've gotten is that people like hearing the thought process that goes behind analyzing some of these stories. And so they really like the back and forth because it, you know, it unearths some of those, you know, the less obvious things, thinking that goes behind some security, kind of the higher level security.
Sure. And, you know, we don't always agree. So
no,
probably
no.
Get into some epic debates at some point.
And, absolutely.
And you guys can't see the video that we have, but there's flipping off going on back and forth, just so you know. And it'll probably get worse.
All right. Well, I don't want to waste everybody's time any more than we have already had. I appreciate everyone listening in, as always. It's great talking to everybody every week. As usual, you can find the podcast on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. That would be the U.S. spelling, by the way. And on Twitter at DefensiveSec. You can find me on Twitter at MaliciousLink. You can find Mr. Kellett on Twitter at Lurg. And with that, we will talk to you again next week with a whole bunch more of exciting and uplifting stories. Have a good one. Bye.